I'm Jill Surgeson, a nurse midwife and researcher fascinated by the concept of trust and its role in our most meaningful relationships. Trust isn't just personal. It influences our health, our communities, and our institutions. In this podcast, we'll explore how trust manifests across different aspects of society, where it thrives, where it breaks down, and what we can do to build it. Through conversations with experts from a variety of disciplines, we'll examine how trustworthiness can lead to a more equitable and fulfilling world. Welcome to Trust Fund.
I'm a former midwife who is now getting a PhD in nursing. When I first made that decision, my heart broke a little with the idea of sacrificing my days previously filled with tender conversations with women and families about their babies, my happy hands on wiggly domed bellies, for the sterile, hallowed halls of academia. I was in for a surprise. I immediately was taught and mentored by Dr. Rosa Gonzalez-Corda, who taught me that research is about love, respect, and community as much as it is about validity and statistical regressions. Her words and example freed me up to bring my whole heart to research, and it is more than a pleasure and an honor to be able to speak with her today. And you will see why she is such a beloved part of the Duke School of Nursing community. Rosa is associate professor at the Duke School of Nursing and the outgoing assistant dean of the PhD program. Her main roles as a faculty member include conducting research, teaching and mentoring, which she does beautifully, and service. Her research explores the intersection of substance abuse, violence, HIV, and mental health among Latinx communities and social drivers of these. She holds a Bachelor's of Science in Nursing, Master of Science in Nursing focused on public health nursing, Master in Public Health, and an interdisciplinary PhD in Nursing Epidemiology and Psychology. Throughout her career, she has volunteered in many community-based organizations and initiatives, including many organizations specifically serving Latinx communities and organizations that address domestic violence.
Thank you.
I'm so happy to be with you.
Being here today.
Of course.
I haven't intentionally tried to start each podcast with a fun fact about somebody, but I do think that I would like to acknowledge that if I had a fun fact about you, is that you're probably the only Cuban American breakdancing dean at Duke.
Probably. Yeah, I would say so. I think so.
When did you learn to do that?
Breakdown dean?
Breakdancing.
Oh, breakdancing. Well, you know, I've always been a wannabe since I was a kid. And growing up in Miami, and we grew up always dancing and dance parties. I was going to dance parties since I was in fourth grade, right? And so we would have battle dancing. And I'd have to show up sometimes, you know? So I learned a few key moves that I bring out every now and then.
I'm looking forward to seeing them.
Yeah, and I actually brought it out at my wedding. In my gown.
I do need to say that.
I do. I was listening to a recording of my little one who has such cute questions. Mm-hmm. And this was many years ago. He was probably like 5. He was asking me what I want to be when I grow up. And I told him, I want to be a nurse researcher. But he's like, no, mommy, what do you want to be when you grow up? Like, I'm not an adult yet. No. I said, I want to be a dancer. So maybe I'll do that in my sabbatical. Learn to break dance legitimately.
Yeah, which is coming up. So I'm glad we caught you.
Yes.
Before you take this well.
Yeah, we'll get back to this in 6 months, see if I achieved my goals.
So we've hit on something already that I want to kind of expand on more, which is that I've been lucky enough to know you through Duke and just as a person, and it's been so lovely, and to take your class. And when I think of your work, I always think of it as being at this intersection of nursing, community health, and structural equity.
Mm-hmm.
Would you describe your work along similar lines?
Yeah, definitely. I think that the community work that I do is in that interstitial space between policy and impact. And it's a way to kind of influence a realm that is in between these two spaces, between what is directed in a higher level policy-wise and the impact on people's lives, that you do have an opportunity to serve, to either bridge those in a positive way or interrupt things in also a way that benefits society.
So you did mention that you grew up in Miami.
I did, yes.
And your parents are from Cuba. Was there anything specific about where and how you were raised or culturally that has had an influence on your, not just your research topics, but exactly what you were saying, which is working in that very important, often ill-defined space of research and community involvement?
Completely. So much of me and what I do is really informed by my upbringing in a enclave in Miami where the majority of people are Cuban. So I grew up in this part of Miami where everyone spoke Spanish. Mm. When I went to school, my teachers were mostly Cuban. So this is why I have an accent when I speak English. My teachers spoke to me in English, but they had accents, right?
Interesting.
And I had the opportunity to grow up with a lot of pride. I was a minority group in a majority community, right? So I wasn't minoritized. I hadn't had that minoritized experience of feeling othered. I was actually very much part of the group that had the strong cultural, political presence. Our mayors were Cuban, right? And so I grew up with a strong cultural and ethnic identity and a strong social and community network. My grandma lived across the street, and my aunt and my uncle, my little cousin. And so I felt like I had all the opportunities growing up to succeed. And my family, my parents, they started a family business. And although when I was younger, I do recall that we had very limited means, I experienced the American dream in that I saw my parents' hard work translate to social mobility. And there was a time where my family made enough money that, you know, for a lot of Latinos in the United States, going to a Catholic school is really important. So I remember when my parents could finally afford sending us to Catholic school.
I see.
Right? Yeah. And we continue to progress. And so a lot of what drives me is, A, gratitude for my upbringing, and B, a recognition that that was completely shaped by political and social factors, or at least partly shaped in a very significant way. Because Cubans in the United States at that time had a lot of political advantages. We had laws that protected us from helped us seek out refugee status. And so there was this wet foot, dry foot policy where Cubans that stepped foot on land were protected and from being there and never considered to be deported.
Why?
Right? We had legal protections. And also, you know, given that there were people in power from the same community that our family was from, when my parents started their business and they had problems, they were able to reach out to the mayor for help, right? So those are all sort of privileges that are not afforded to everyone. And so a lot of the work that I do is really trying to make sure that all immigrant communities and Latino immigrant communities have access to those opportunities.
And the broad umbrella, I think, of one of your many areas of excellence is community engaged research. And do you mind explaining how the approach to community engaged research is maybe different than how people think about traditional research?
Yeah. So traditional research is really based on an investigator's assessment of what the state of the sciences and what are pressing health problems, and using their expertise and training to identify what is the best way to answer questions that address that problem and design methods to help you answer those in a valid way, right? Mm-hmm. And in community-engaged research, you do that completely in partnership with the communities that you work with, right? So together, you identify areas of priority. together you identify what are the opportunities that to answer and generate new knowledge that is needed by the communities and to design the research in a way that is going to be most respectful, best reaching, best engaging of the communities that you want to engage in that research. And then finally, to analyze and interpret the findings in a way that makes sense and that allows for a translation, for impact.
Yeah, that translation into policy seems to be lacking in context or even in kind of sustainability or impact if you don't have it informed by the people who are going to be affected by the policy, right? And so I think we've all seen that, you know, evidence being generated in academic environments. But really, in practice, it doesn't work because it wasn't informed by the experience of the people with whom, you know, it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Had an impact. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's also the people who you want to use your research to impact the people that you ultimately want to impact. So if, it, you know, in our case, it's we're wanting to improve the health of the Latino immigrant community. Right. And there's lots of, you know, interest holders that impact this community. Mm-hmm. There's people themselves, right? We all have agency, or the community itself has agencies. But there's healthcare providers, there's community-based organizational leaders, there's policymakers that you ultimately want to use your findings and implement that, right? So engaging those different interest holders is also another critical part of the engagement process.
Mm-hmm. And I think it just, I'm going to note as a side note here that this isn't a purely academic experience for you, that you actually have embedded yourself into organizations within our Durham community, like El Futuro, for example, who are doing this. And I'm curious about how staying in the same community in some ways, but kind of switching up your roles, how has that had an impact or enhanced your research experience?
Well, that's such a good question because I, you know, my clinical background's in public health nursing. And in my journey as a public health nurse, I always wanted to be in the community embedded doing grassroots work. So early on, I remember being very critical of researchers and saying they're sellouts. They're in their ivory tower behind their computers, and that's not who I want to be, right? But I had this transformative experience when I was a graduate student at Hopkins where there was this syphilis outbreak in the Latino community, and there was very few bilingual, bicultural healthcare providers, period, in the region. I was in, you know, in Baltimore, Maryland. And I had this incredible experience as a graduate student to work with the CDC and the health department to investigate what was driving the outbreak and then to design a syphilis intervention strategy.
Wow.
And in that, the first thing I did was look at the evidence. What is the evidence based around, you know, what drives this in the Latino community? What has been effective in terms of prevention? And I found that there was nothing. Right. And so that made me realize that to be a good public health nurse, I needed to become a researcher and develop skills to be able to research and make sure that what we're developing has an impact. So that made me realize I wanted to do a PhD, but I was never really sold on being an academic scholar. And it was the platform that was clear to me at that time, and I'll say that because I think it may change, right? Mm-hmm. At that time, I felt that my platform in an academic setting will allow for me to best use my resources and have access to the kind of funding to be able to develop and test meaningful strategies to reach this community. But you know, I have questions sometimes, is it better suited to do that out of a community-based organization like El Futuro, right? It's just that the funding historically has prioritized academic knowledge generators versus community-based knowledge generators. And we started to see a shift in that prior to this current administration at the National Institutes of Health, for example, where they started to fund community-driven research that is coming from community organizations versus the academic institutions. And then they require the community organizations to partner with academic institutions. But me being embedded in community organizations as a board member, as partner in research has helped me see the perspective of, you know, the perspective from different viewpoints of in a community organization versus a academic institution. And more recently, I've started to work with families that are not connected with organizations. And that presents some unique viewpoints and opportunities, but also some unique challenges.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
When you are navigating and kind of holding both these things, your commitment to the community, your commitment to research, do you ever find that there's tension? I think people underestimate how slowly research moves. And when you're working with communities and you've been honored to have their buy-in and their participation, and that confers a commitment to that community. Have you ever had a situation where there is some tension in terms of timelines, progress, people wanting things to move at a different rate than they're happening? Or do you find that people are willing to move themselves into the research space and work with that process along the way?
There's always a challenge.
Okay.
With that, we have very different timelines in academia and in the community. So the way that I've tried my best to leverage this is when we're working on a research project where we're trying to generate new knowledge, that's the essence of what we're trying to do, and there's an immediate need that you need to respond to.
Like COVID.
Like COVID.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's a great example. You have to address the immediate need while you're continuing to address the research question. An example of that during COVID was we're in the middle of our CETIF panel study, which is a longitudinal study of Latino immigrants, adults, over a two-year period, and we were studying stress and resilience and the impact on syndemic health conditions.
Yeah.
I can talk more about that later, but and then we were also looking at biomarkers, the impact on biomarkers over time. So we had collected all our baseline data, luckily, and then COVID hit, right? We had to pivot our research methods. We were able to do that and continue to follow people. But more importantly, we saw that Latinos were disproportionately affected by infection, morbidity, and mortality. And so we actually developed a strategy to reach out to all our participants. We had a doctoral student at the time, Liz Felmatos, who's a nurse practitioner, that part of her role was reaching out proactively before we were doing any follow-up data collection, just to check in with people, make sure that they knew where to go to get tested and what the resources were. We reached out to them when we started working on vaccination events and connecting them to resources that we found that were of need over time. Food, housing, and we were able to use some of our data for helping us understand what is needed in the response. For example, there was a lot of discussion early on about one of the things that were putting the Latino community at risk was living in multi-generational households. Yes. We had data to show that actually it's more than that. We have about 30% of our participants that were living in multi-family households. So these are, you know, multiple families coming together to be able to pay rent.
Sure. Yeah.
And to share, you know, support one another with our housing needs. And that was contributing to some of the risk that we saw in this population.
You said something that I loved, and I love Liz Vell, and she's an amazing person. And this is a podcast essentially about trust and trustworthiness, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But not to ask you to speak for the community members, but for you as researchers, what role did taking the proactive step of checking in with people serve in terms of your feeling about building trustworthiness or having trustworthiness in your practice? Because for a community that's often ghosted, for lack of a better term, they're invisible in so many ways. I can imagine that there was something really deeply touching about having someone reach out of concern for your well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something so beautiful about that, and maybe a little surprising for people, even. Did you notice that there was an effect of that in building those kind of trusting connections with the community?
Yeah, I think one of the core values that we have, our team has, is cariño y respeto, love and respect. People don't often, or scientists don't often talk about love in research, but we love our participants. They have, you know, they have given so much of their lives and shared so much of their lives with us that we love them and we respect them and their dignity. And so there's no other choice than to check in with them and to make sure that they have all the resources that they need if you love and respect them. When we were establishing engagement in the study, we part of our strategy is that we go and visit people in their houses. We give them the choice if they prefer to go to an office at a Centro Hispano.
Uh-huh.
And then through COVID, we offered, you know, you can meet with us on Zoom.
Right? Sure. Okay.
We're actually offering that to now because of the immigration climate and safety issues. Whatever people want and feel safe. But there's something very special and very connected when you go to someone's house and you sit next to them in their couch and you have the opportunity to learn from their lives. And our, you know, in our studies, we ask very sensitive questions. Immigration, stress, family, sex, violence, mental health, trauma, adverse childhood experiences. It's like very... very heavy stuff, very intimate things, and people share their lives with us. And so we love them, and we develop a good relationship where we hope that they love us too and respect us too. We have felt that in the ways that they interrelate to us. And at the end of the day, that's not only just, you know, ethical and respectful practice, but it also makes the quality of the data so much better. Because We learn more, right?
Absolutely. You can see me tearing up. I did a study last summer, and I loved my participants so much. One asked me to come deliver her baby. And these are people that I knew via Zoom, but I think that's been such a... almost a patriarchal approach to research, right? That there's something about we have to keep an emotional distance from our subject, you know, so we call them subjects, we don't call them people, or, you know, there's been this very extreme attempt to avoid bias, and it really is important to avoid bias in research. And yet there is a place, as you've shown, where research can be deeply enhanced by building these respectful, loving relationships with the people that you serve, because research is ultimately about service, I think. I'm curious to hear how you think about that, because as a young scholar, I think of my research as service. I don't feel like the people who participate in the research serve at my pleasure or, you know, are in service to me.
Yeah.
And so are you finding in research that there is some acceptance of what feels a little bit like a paradigm shift?
Yes, I think so. I think there has been a paradigm shift and an increased recognition of the value and importance of community engagement, not as something that people do,
yeah,
that is specialized, but something that we all need to do to improve our research practice, mm-hmm, and the translation of our research findings. So I definitely think that there's an increased acknowledgement of this as being important and a scientific basis to it there's been lots of studies that have been done to try to identify what are some of the factors that enable participation, diverse participation in clinical trials, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And sadly, you know, we don't have great representation in research studies, which means that there's no scientific equity, right? The ability for everyone to benefit from the generations of science is limited by who's participating in studies. And so the research actually has shown that for Latino participants, you really need to have a very personal approach to engage them in research. If not, they're not going to. It's not because they're not interested in research. They're actually very much drawn to this service orientation of their participation having a community and societal impact. That's what draws them, right? So they want to more than anyone, if anything. It's just that we don't use personal enough approaches to engage them.
What advice would you offer to new researchers who want to engage in and build programs of research around community engaged work, but don't know where to start? And I think sometimes we ask these big questions and we just leave it freeform, but I'm curious about like what first and second steps, particularly, like very granular, and they can be very unsexy steps. But
yeah, I think the first thing is to really define the community that you're wanting to partner with. And in doing that, to identify what exists already in that community. Who are potential gatekeepers that can help introduce you to these communities that already have the trust? For example, I came to Duke in North Carolina almost 9 years ago. And I had a 7-year community-engaged partnership in Miami-Dade County that started to be very productive in terms of us getting the research and having an impact on policy. And it started to get great momentum. So one of the things that I was terrified about was first, you know, that work dying off, which it didn't, which is wonderful. And the second thing is the acknowledgement that it requires a really long investment in time to develop those trusting relationships and that results in some productivity, right? And when I came here, there wasn't much research with the Latino community. It was very scant across the whole campus. The School of Nursing did not have a program of research on Latino health, but we had a lot of community service and education on Latino health. And we had two key players here, Irene Felsman, who's faculty and had been teaching courses in community public health nursing and has a very long, extensive history of partnering with community organizations. And then Rosa Sordarsano, who everyone confuses me, the two Rosas. And she has a long history. She had worked with at a Centro Hispano teaching English and Spanish classes. It started that way. So she was an employee there. And then she came here to the school and she's been a big leader here in the school around helping our healthcare providers not only speak Spanish, but think more from a structural and public health perspective on how to best meet the needs of the Latino community. And so they were the ones that introduced me. And I was able to benefit from the years of investment they had in establishing trust. And because I was associated with them, I had some unearned trust that was given to me, right? But then I had to do my work, right? And show up, I think, is the next most important thing of being there beyond your own self-interest.
Yes.
Not just when you're thinking of asking them to do something, but being there to meet the goals of the community with their priorities. Because that, you know, that's you have to establish that before you can ask to partner on any ideas that you may have or that you hear the community has that you would like to support.
I tell my boys all that all the time. 90% is showing up. Lisa Sorg that we interviewed said the same thing about journalism. And I think when people in community see you at festivals, for example, or observances or some kind of advocacy event, it does engender this camaraderie and this trust that allows people on both sides to kind of lean in into the research relationship as well.
Definitely.
I want to talk a little bit about one of the my favorite things that you study, which is acculturative stress. This is a concept that will make a lot of sense to people, but they may not be familiar with the term. So do you mind explaining what that is and how that is very specifically in this, like how we're very specifically applying it to Latino populations?
Yeah. So acculturative stress is a stress of acculturating to the U.S. context and being a minoritized person in that context. So immigrant populations, of course, experience acculturative stress, but also their children and their grandchildren also experience acculturative stress. This spans beyond the immigrant population in terms of thinking about any context where your culture, there's a dissonance between the dominant culture and the culture that is you and your family's culture, right? So we have studied that for many years, and we have found that acculturative stress is the strongest social determinant of health for Latino immigrant populations. It's the thing that explains the most variance in any outcome that we look at. And we mostly have been looking at behavioral and mental health outcomes, but it was similar when we started to look at biomarkers. We looked at inflammatory cytokines, oxidative stress. We're doing some work now in looking at DNA methylation. So there's many different types of acculturative stressors. What we have found is the dual that is the hardest, that is the most detrimental for our families, is these competing demands related to the stress, the acculturative stress of the family, and acculturative stress related to economic and occupational factors. So for example, when families start feeling that they're having to prioritize work to advance their family and their children's opportunities for education, for income, for advancement in where they live, and they're starting to compromise the closeness and the sacredness of the family, that is such a tension for Latino immigrant families that is very devastating. It's what is the most predictive of intimate partner violence, binge drinking, mental health problems.
This is a syndemic crisis that you're talking about.
Yep.
Here. These co-occurring events.
Yeah, they're like co-occurring risk that emerge over time that Latino immigrants actually have very low rates of, and the more they spend time here in the United States, the more substance use and binge drinking and the more intimate partner violence and the more risky sexual behaviors and the more depression and the more anxiety. And what's driving that is this acculturative stress. And also we study resilience.
Yes, that was my next question. I was like, what's the antidote to that?
So, you know, resilience is the ability to resist and recover and rebound. Rebound is one that I love particularly because it's this idea that a mistress, you have a dip, but you come out stronger.
Yeah.
And we definitely see that. So the other thing at play that we've found is that over time, there's a decay of resilience. And that drives the outcomes that we see. An example of that is We studied in this study that I told you about, Seripano, where we looked at biomarkers. There was this one group that started with very low bad biomarkers, like low inflammation, low CRP, low oxidative stress.
Healthy people.
Super healthy.
Yeah.
Despite the stressful situations.
Yeah.
And had a really sharp increase in the biomarkers in a 2-year period.
So essentially people got less healthy the longer they were in the U.S.
Yeah, well, they generally, the population gets more unhealthy in the U.S., but this group had such a sharp decline over the 2 years that was very concerning. And one of the things that was distinct about that group is that they lost their, there was a rapid decrease in their ethnic pride.
Oh.
So, you know, pride, cultural pride is a huge source of resilience.
Yeah.
And that group lost their pride in those 2 years. This was COVID era. There was a lot of discrimination too. It was, you know, think about it was, we studied between 2017 to 2022. It was during the first Trump administration where we, you know, when we saw this, and there was a lot of local anti-immigrant sentiment and anti-immigrant laws and policies that were being passed at that time. And so we are expecting now in this era, we're testing an intervention that's based on that finding with community health workers. And one of the big things we're addressing is immigration-related stressors. And we're trying to provide some tools for families to be able to enhance and maintain their resilience so that they're better prepared to navigate these waters that we're in right now.
Right, because it's just supposition, but I can imagine that this is almost unprecedented in terms of threats or the feeling, just this sort of heavy tape of worry and dread all the time in many people. And we know what that does to people in a short term, right? But to have that maintained for a long time and this almost arbitrary nature of being plucked or selected or whatever is, it's an extraordinary amount of burden to place on someone's psyche and thus body.
Absolutely. And the impact is beyond that individual. So, so we have seen from other studies that have been done that when there's threats around like immigration and deportation, that it has an impact not only on undocumented or mixed status households, it's the general population in general. You know, when you're part of a group that is being oppressed, it affects you whether you're a citizen or not, or what kind of status you have.
I want to shift a little bit to nursing.
Mm-hmm.
And you have been the dean of the PhD program here at Duke, and I've been so lucky. And given what we've talked about and what we're seeing and how nurses have been increasingly, I think, recognized as central figures in healthcare systems and delivery, how do you feel like the nursing profession is uniquely positioned to drive this kind of structural change in communities and in public health, whether you're a researcher or not?
Yeah, I think that that one foundational thing is really all about what this podcast is about, is the trust.
Yeah.
Right? So we love to brag about that.
Me too.
About that.
We earned it.
We definitely earned it. And the thing that I think that is unique about us is that we actually have established a scientific basis of trust. We don't talk about it that way. There's a science of trust.
Right.
And that science of trust involves some things that nurses are trained to do. Yes. We're trained, whether we're scientists or not, we're trained to always look at both subjective and objective data, right? We're trained to make sure that patient-centered care and family-centered care is front and is the first thing, the main driver of the way that we design care. It's not an afterthought, right? We're trained to think about the person completely within the context of their family, the community, and we understand as trained translational scientists of, we know how to translate what is happening in a bigger level in healthcare or in policy to the immediate close needs of people and families. And that is what makes us very unique in leading science in this area.
Amen. Yes. Amen.
And just like we care, like we're trained as clinicians in this perspective, I love the way we train our nurse scientists. There's obviously some areas that we need to improve on, but I loved that we train our nurse scientists to be able to use all sorts of kinds of tools to answer yeah. the main important questions. Mm-hmm. So they can draw from qualitative and quantitative designs, mixed methods designs, to comprehensively describe a phenomenon in a way that other scientists are not trained. And because we're nurses and we want to have an impact, we're also trained on methods to be able to develop and test strategies to improve the problems that we're studying, right? So it doesn't stop with just the knowledge generation, but we are translational scientists and we learn to translate those into interventions and policies and study if those work or how to design them and how to scale them.
Exactly. And I think small P policies and then big P policy as well. And, you know, we've talked a lot about how we are committed to seeing more nurses in larger policy roles as well. And I think, as I said to you before, I think nurses are the perfect bridge between communities and their needs and larger policy. So I love that. So one more question before we go. And that is, what is giving you hope right now in your work? And what is keeping you grounded?
That's such a good question. What is giving me hope is the families and the people that I work with and what they're doing to support each other. And knowing that no matter what happens in terms of the political climate and what organizations are doing or not doing, that communities are coming together and supporting one another. And I know that that is a foundational strength of the communities that I work with, come from, and work for. And so I feel like, you know, if they can do it, I can do it too, right? Oh. If they're doing that, then I can also rely on too in sort of leading this kind of work during these political times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Hey, before you go, here's a shameless plea. If you like this episode, hit that subscribe button wherever you listen to your podcast. That way you'll never miss a new episode. You can also find more about us at trustfundpodcast.com and follow us on Instagram and LinkedIn. If you loved what you've heard, I trust you to leave a 5-star rating. It really helps others find the show. Trust Fund is a production of Jill Surgeson and the Duke University School of Nursing.